Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and co-founder of Creating the Future, where our mission is to make visionary community change the norm in this sector rather than the exception. It is my privilege to host this podcast, where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. It is my pleasure to have Peter Block as my guest today on Making Change. I have to confess, I love Peter's online bio. It says, "Peter Block is an author, consultant, and citizen of Cincinnati, Ohio." Anyone who is familiar with Peter's work knows that it is those last four words, "citizen of Cincinnati, Ohio," that may just be the most important to him. Peter has been authoring best-selling books for over three decades. Most pertinent to the work of community benefit organizations are his books, The Answer to How is Yes, and Community, The Structure of Belonging. His latest book, The Abundant Community, Awakening the Power of Families and Neighborhoods, was co-authored with John McKnight, who joined us as a guest here on Making Change back in December of 2010, and whose interview you can hear in the archives of this program at philanthropy.com. The thread that runs through all of Peter's books is the theme of creating communities that work for all of us, whether those communities are workplaces, neighborhoods, or Peter's own home community of Cincinnati, Ohio. Given his lifetime of dedication to creating the experience of belonging in those communities, it is my pleasure to have Peter Block share his observations with us today, here on Making Change. My guest today needs virtually no introduction. It is Peter Block. Peter, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Nice of you to invite me.
I start all of our conversations with pretty much the same question. When you see transformation happening in communities, and you have seen so many different communities doing such amazing things over your career, what do you see happening when you see change happening, when you see transformation happening? What factors are at play? And if you want to tell a story or you want to share what works, what doesn't work?
I think when you say change happening, of course, it's happening all the time, but you use the word transformation. So transformation means it's a shift of some magnitude, not in scale, but in thinking. So you might say, what does it take for a collective, a gathering, a culture to shift its thinking about what it's up to or how it wants to live out its intentions? One thing I have seen is that scale works against transformation. So everybody that starts large, change the world, change the city, nothing much happens. Everybody who starts with a lot of money, nothing much happens. Everybody who starts who thinks leadership is essential, I have little faith in that belief. The idea that best practices, what worked elsewhere, how can we import that? So this to me is conventional. The conventional wisdom says that leaders, money, scale, speed are essential to significant transformation. I've lost faith in that. And so you're really talking about neighborhoods. You're talking about local groups. And so that's just the first thought. Is that Hewlett-Packard spent $18 million. I saw a study in East Palo Alto and everything east of Route 101. And they then did a study of why their original project didn't really become successful. They were in about three communities. And what was interesting to me is they saw that there was little social fabric in the places that they were investing. And the people doing the study said that there wasn't enough connection, and therefore we need better strategies. And so to me, it was stunning that the very thing they wasted their money on, they thought they needed more of.
Yeah.
Because everybody wants to load the money up front with as much strategic thinking, as much blueprint creation as humanly possible. And while they know that related discounts, nobody invests in it. And so I think that's where we're stuck as a culture. And the places I've seen that made a difference are places that are relationship projects that are relationship based, where people have been together with each other in a place, not online, not globally, not a community of practice or a community of interest. I do not believe for a minute that tweeting created the revolution in Egypt. Okay, and so it's really place-based. You can get your arms around it. Even if it's a neighborhood, it's about the best you can do in a large city. Now, people who run large cities, who run large companies, will claim victory and talk how much things have been transformed, but the essentials haven't. Nothing's been transformed. They just invested a lot of money, and sometimes it's a good investment. So place, size, relatedness. To me, there's a center for great neighborhoods in Covington, Covington, Kentucky. And the guy running that has been there for 18 years, mm-hmm. and he lives in that place. And he makes a difference because when he shows up, people say, well, he's one of us. He belongs here. And so all real social transformation, to me, is on a foundation of social fabric and connection. And so that's one thought. The other belief that I have is that everything I've seen make a difference was based on people's gifts and based on their capacity and showed a deep disdain and disinterest in what's wrong, in deficiencies.
That is a real big thing to sort of breathe in, mm-hmm. that
stunning.
The focus on what's wrong is actually what's wrong.
Beautiful. Conversation over. You know,
yeah.
I really think so. And the whole infrastructure of what you call community benefit, I love the term civic benefit, which means that we're no longer talking about not-for-profits, because in that way we define ourselves by what we're not. Mm-hmm. And the whole infrastructure is about deficiencies, needs, problems. And so you can take any modest or poor neighborhood in any city and describe it by what's wrong with it. And the description's always the same. Economics, education, mortality, infant mortality, obesity, all the things. And to focus on those as deficiency-based kind of intervention is always a mistake, because what you see is what you get. And if you want more deficiencies, they're there for the asking. And so the real changes I've seen are communities that have discovered and organizations that have discovered that we have gifts and capacities nobody dreamed about. Every low-income project has its local economy. It has people that are making a living in their home. It has more compassion than any place you find in a wealthy suburb. That people care for each other's children. They care for each other. They watch out for each other. Now, normal measures would say that's a problem area because they're poor, undereducated, etc. So that to me is a huge thing.
You know, it's been interesting, Peter. I'm looking at the two things that you noted. You noted connection and relatedness, mm-hmm. and you noted building on people's gifts. And the thing that I've observed over time is that when people come together, so you get that connectedness. When they come together over the needs, when they come together over the deficits, when they come together over what's wrong, it brings out the absolute worst in them.
Mm.
And so I'm really smiling at the direct link between those two, that when they are connected over over what's wrong, it sort of brings them all within their shell. You get that survival fear. You get all of our basest of instincts. When they come together over what's possible, it's a very, very different coming together.
So, amen. If you come together about deficiencies, what you do is get people who are cranky and entitled. Then they begin to believe that someone else is the cause of their own deficiency. So you might say a third thing is that people come together to get related, to focus on gifts, and they focus on the future they can produce with their own hands.
Tell me a little bit about that. Tell me what you've seen.
Well, they don't believe that the city council needs to do anything to change their lives. Mm. They don't need the support of top management. They don't need the support of the board. They don't need support of executive leadership. They don't need the business, the community to get it. All right. They don't need the high-end fine arts group to care about grassroots music. They don't need the developers to put more, mixed income housing in my neighborhood.
So what do they need?
Well, they need to decide what do we need to do to raise our children. And they don't go to the schools to raise their children. They say, we will raise our children. So there's an Appalachian council here in Cincinnati, and they're unique. And and they say, if the schools don't work for their kids, they say, the hell with them, we'll take them out and we'll teach them ourselves. And so the notion that systems can be reformed by highly active citizens, I've lost faith in them. Because we've asked systems to do things in which they reach their capacities. And I'm sure John McKnight talked about this. But I want to raise my children. I don't want to look to the school to do more. It's doing too much already. I want a safe neighborhood, but I don't want to look to the police to keep me safe. I want to be healthy, but I want to avoid the health care system.
So what can organizations do to make that possible? What are the factors that, because there are organizations filled with people who do care, who are connected to their communities, how can they engender that empowering, that self-empowering?
They have to get it in their minds first, okay? Change your thinking, change your life. And they have to decide that we are here to organize the gifts and capacities of the people that we care about. So one of the most successful is people in the developmental disabilities arena. And so there's a guy named Joe Erpenbeck who works for the developmental disabilities for the government, Hamilton County here in Cincinnati. And most there, they surround disabled people with services. So every developmentally disabled person, most of the people around them, all their lives have been paid people, every one of which is a compassionate, loving, patient human being. So this is not about individuals need to change. But what Joe does, every time somebody comes through there, they say, what do you love to do? What are your passions? Where would you like? And all he is interested in is finding them and creating a circle of support around them that supports what they love to do. And mostly what they love to do is they like to be in some people like to sit in a pharmacy. Some people like to go to a cafe or a bowling alley. Some people like to walk or roll their wheelchairs up and down a street and say, okay, we're going to find people who will help you support you do that. And we're interested, no matter what your conditions, we're interested in what your desires are and what your gifts are. And they have many gifts. Usually those people who are happier because they're around. They're welcoming. People recovering from mental illness are amazing listeners. And many of them will listen to me in a way that nobody's ever. And so it may not, rather than saying, well, we need to put you in a workshop, we need to develop your skills, you say, what do you know how to do? So the agencies working with this first need to decide, this is what we're here for. There's a Methodist church, Mike Mayer, or Mahler, I'm not sure, in Methodist Church in Indianapolis stopped all of the charitable activities, the soup kitchens, the training programs, the GED programs. And he said, why don't we find out what the people in this neighborhood can do? And he hired somebody to walk around and knock on doors and say, what do you love to do? What are you interested in? What are you willing to teach other people? And he found out they like to cook. They like to take care of kids. Some people are excellent at prayers. Some people know how to fish. Some people can fix cars. Some people like animals. Some people like the garden. This is the function of neighborhoods. And so now he's helping these people commercialize or expand what they know and love to do that nobody ever saw before, because we saw them as they were needy. They didn't have money. They thought they hadn't graduated high school. So those are the kinds of actions. Now they're small scale. They don't have much money associated with them, and they don't make the news. But to me, that's where real real change is happening. And, it doesn't matter where. The other thing is they go local. So many agencies and so many people who have a loving and generous disposition want to go to Africa and be useful there. You know, if there's a crisis in Tuscaloosa, we want to go and help them out. Well, you don't have to go to Africa. All you got to do is walk down the street. I don't care where you live. Whatever it is, the difference you want to make in the world is occurring. You're needed by your neighbors. And so in some ways, neighborliness is the goal. And wherever the agency is located, I would just say whatever you can walk to is where you're going to find purpose and meaning in the world. And you have to reframe it. You know, somebody introduced themselves and said, I'd like to meet my friend Johnny. He's homeless. And I thought, that's not who he is. Why would you introduce this man as homeless? I don't say my name's Peter and I'm housed.
You know, it's interesting. We did work a while ago when we were still consulting with an organization that provides non-medical support for folks who have cancer. Yeah. And just what you're talking about, they provide the non-medical side. So yes, there's counseling, but there's ballroom dancing, there's gardening, there's whatever makes people feel whole and healthy. Because what they found is very much what you're talking about. When someone has a debilitating disease, we start to look at them as if they are their disease rather exactly. than a person who happens to have this but has a whole lot of other good stuff.
Exactly. And the truth is our interventions with those diseases have not been that successful anyhow. You know, in the extreme they are, of course, you want a doctor to cut up a wound. One of the things that John and I talk about is that we decided to die of natural causes. John says, I don't need a disease as an excuse to die. And so why would we take our identity from our illness, from our disease, from our homelessness, from my lack of education? Why don't I take my identity from, you know, what I'm capable of doing? So from an organization's point of view, they can decide anytime they want to whoever they're there to serve to focus on what their gifts and capacities are. So I'm part of a hip hop center called Elements in Cincinnati. And we deal with youth in some of the more disinvested with neighborhoods in the city. And when they walk in the door, all we care about is what they love. And it turns out what they love is music. They learn to write music. They learn to engineer. They learn to record music. They can sing if they want. They can learn how to break dance and street dance if they want. They can learn graffiti and they can learn to DJ. We have no interest in their history. I am not even interested in their story. You know, people on the edge are so used to telling their story as a selling strategy. And, you know, raised by a single this, not know where I'm going tonight, no money. All of those stories to me are just fiction. They're just stories. They're little narratives that are an obstacle to an alternative future. So any agency, whether it's the Y or Boys and Girls Club, in this case it's Elements, a hip-hop center, a center for hip-hop and respect is what we call it. All we care about it, and then they learn discipline. They learn respect. They learn some structure. We say, you want to record music? Great. Here's what you have to do. You've got to schedule studio time. You have to take a course and learn something about using the equipment. You have to help other younger people when they come in here, because at the ages of 14 to 24. And so any agency, I don't care what your purpose is. The police job is community organizing. The why. All we know about healthcare is that having a social network is the most healing thing you can do. A friend of mine, Paul Ulick, is a thoracic surgeon. And he says, I worry about fixing people, opening up their hearts and closing them back. And I don't want to see them again in a year. So they need to change their behavior. He says, the only ones that have a shot at it are ones that find a network and a social group in which to get support. So it doesn't matter. Returning felons, what do we do with them? Job training won't help. What helps is having them find a support group that keeps
community.
Them straight.
And community. Having community. You know, I'm listening to the words that you used for the surgeon. The opening their hearts and closing it back up. There is such metaphor in that.
I know.
For exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly.
We do. We open people's hearts and we. Yeah. One of the things that I'm hearing You mentioned before taking our identity from what's wrong. And I'm thinking about how much of the, and I'm using the word with intent, nonprofit sector, because it's seeing themselves negatively. Yeah. I'm wondering how much of that sector really is taking its identity as organizations from what's wrong, and how life changes for those organizations when they take their identity from what's possible.
They take it from what, exactly. I mean, you said it beautifully. Also, you know, the world tells them they should be more like a business.
Yeah.
Which is such foolishness. You know, in one area of the city here, they have 113 civic benefit or community benefit organizations. And so the business and the elected official community says, we have too many. And I think, how can you have too much compassion? Every civic benefit or community benefit organization is a center for democracy and generosity. You can't say that about an antique store.
Right.
You know, we don't say there's 100 antique stores in this area. That's too many.
That's too many.
You know, and so the first you have to let go of the business mindset that efficiency, cost, and measurement are too small a god to worship. As soon as you say we want to measure our results, we want to be accountable, we want to be efficient, you've forgotten what you're there for. And so that's the other shift in thinking. And if you look at the successful civic benefit places, you will see beneath the conversation of how many kids' lives they've saved, that they have created a powerful local civic network of caring people. And the best leaders are those that can bring citizens and volunteers together with each other. It's not their leadership style, it's so unique. And so this is the whole, I think, cultural shift that is occurring. And you have people who are storytellers. You know, Yes Magazine does a great job of talking with people about what people are doing that works. So over time, because the news organizations are ones who have a huge influence on the narrative. And right now the narrative of my city is there's something wrong with us. Every evening news starts with what's wrong with us, and if there's nothing wrong with us, we'll find some place where there is something wrong. And so the revolution that you're giving voice to is one based on the belief that what we have is enough. And focusing on that we don't have enough is what keeps us stuck. And I don't care how poor you are. I don't want to hear about that. Of course people are poor. Of course they never had a chance. And at the end of the day, every person can construct their life. They just can't do it on their own. Of course people need us. Of course they need medical intervention, and they need the Y, and they need the Boys and Girls Clubs, and they need somebody to worry about the cause of cancer. But if that's all we do, and we still treat these people as patients, you know, needy ones, if we offer too much compassion, we're not changing their lives. We're just postponing the real transformation.
Well, Peter, thank you. I cannot believe that the time has gone so quickly. Oh. I'd love to be able to continue this conversation at another time in another couple of months. Hopefully
sure.
You can come back and join us again.
Happy to do it. Thank you very much.
Peter Block, thank you so much for being with us on Making Change.
Thanks, Hilda. Bye-bye.
Speaking with Peter, it's clear that the aim of our work as both organizations and communities starts with the questions at the heart of that work. When we ask what's wrong, we stay focused on what's wrong, and that's where the conversation stays. But ask what's possible, and we address what's wrong along the way. I love the story Peter told about the hip-hop center in his hometown of Cincinnati, Elements. We're all so familiar with programs that are set up with the best intentions to help at-risk youth. As those programs identify the various needs of that at-risk population, it's not unusual to identify the need for structure in what otherwise are relatively unstructured lives. The next logical question from that problem-solving perspective is, how can we create a program to teach these young people structure? Elements turns that on its head. Instead of aiming at fixing problems for young people, it taps into their dreams. They ask, what do you want to create? As young people learn how to turn their dreams into reality, they learn structure and discipline and a whole lot more, all aimed at something that is self-inspiring for them. Instead of taking their identity from the various labels of what's wrong with them, the young people who hang out and learn at Elements take their identity from their own possibilities. In our own experience at Creating the Future, graduates from our programs find the results are as consistent as they are in every example Peter shared. Which leads to this question about your own organization's work. How can you reframe your programs to aim at the future your community members want to build for themselves rather than aiming at what's wrong with them? What questions can you start asking that will move you from treating and providing services to clients and move you towards engaging and organizing the strengths in your neighbors? And then the bigger question, how can you stop seeing your organization itself as a place of need? Never enough money, never enough people. What if your organization's leaders asked the same questions they asked the kids at Elements? What do you want to create? As you begin exploring the possibilities your organization can reach for in your own community, I hope you'll share your observations at the Chronicle of Philanthropy's Making Change group at LinkedIn. If you're not already a member of the Making Change group, please join us there. And remember that you can always find great ways to connect, plus terrific information overall, at the Chronicle's website, philanthropy.com, or follow the Chronicle on Twitter at @philanthropy. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me through our website at creatingthefuture.org. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for your community and our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the second Thursday of next month here on Making Change.